In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of my podcast this week is Justin Chen, co-founder and CEO of Picfoo.
The focus on those industries, I think, is super important because, like you said, it's really hard to market a general purpose tool. But when you're able to speak directly to people about their problems and the use cases, it resonates so much more quickly. So for e-commerce and gaming, doing the marketing and starting to tailor the product much more specifically to those industries, I think is really important to getting our traction.
This is Justin. When he and his co-founder, Johnny Lee, were working on another business, they disagreed and wanted a fast, informed way to break the tie. Being software engineers, they build it. And that's what sparked the big idea behind Picfoo. And although it stayed on the back burner for years, like all the best treasures on the internet, people discovered it. Customers used the polling platform and shared it with their friends. Then, in 2018, they started to see increased attention from e-commerce conferences and podcasts. And this is where they realized they had built something truly useful. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Justin to my podcast. We explore what's broken in consumer research. Justin then takes us through his journey to the moment where they decided to go all in. He explains why he decided to niche down and what criteria appear to be really important to get traction. He elaborates on how they were creating defensible differentiation. And last but not least, he explains how they're designing for stickiness across products, customer success, and marketing. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how often the best solutions are not the ones that help you do the task correctly, but giving the confidence to even consider doing the task at all. Secondly, that even if companies have sorted your problem higher up in the organization, doesn't mean that everyone has access to that, and that's an opportunity. Thirdly, how focusing on habit building helped to make the product mission critical for some verticals and reduce churn at the same time. And lastly, what adjustments he's been making to make NRR calculations more reliable and relevant. Well, hi, Justin. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's a pleasure. It's a topic that's been around on the podcast a couple of times, but every time in a different type of angle. And I was intrigued by the journey of the company and by the whole thing of like that everybody, of course, wants to understand. Know what sells before you sell it.
Exactly.
And that you have a platform to kind of get your finger around it. Yeah, sooner rather than later, right? So that's how it got going. So before we start and dig into your company, Picfoo, what drives you and what gives you energy as a person?
I really love problem solving. And, you know, even with entrepreneurship, I think it's more just the journey that's interesting and trying to build something that makes customers happy. And that's actually what drew us to Picfoo when we were actually building a different business when we built this as a side project. But the customer feedback and the stories we were getting from Pickfood customers was just so heartwarming and so, you know, motivating that we decided we had to move all of our effort over to this one and really solve the problem of democratizing consumer research, because we saw this need. And that's what motivates us, is just, you know, being able to build a simple solution to a problem that a lot of people have.
That's the best way to start a startup, right? Well, kind of, that's a nice bridge that you're making there. So you started the business in 2008. So that's 16 years ago.
16.
it almost feels like eternity. I mean, I have been around longer in the industry, but it's a long time, specifically in this particular internet age. So what was the problem that you initially saw to start a business in the first place? And then let's talk about like the reason for the pivot.
Yeah. So a couple of years before that, my co-founder and I were building a different business, completely unrelated. It was a website, a restaurant website, directory. And at the time, we were going through a redesign. And so we had a couple redesign options from our designer. And my co-founder and I just couldn't decide which way to go. And by that point, we had kind of exhausted our capital with our friends and family, asking them all the time, like, which one do you think? Which one do you think? And so we wanted to find a way to ask strangers. And being introverts and engineers, we didn't want to go to a coffee shop and actually ask real people. So we wanted to build a digital focus group to get feedback. And that's kind of where Pickfood came from. So we built it as a side project initially, threw it up online, figured other entrepreneurs could use it to do idea validation. And that's where it started. And it slowly evolved as we started discovering that this was solving a problem of, you know, entrepreneurs and small businesses and even mid-sized and enterprise businesses not having really easy to use consumer research that doesn't require a ton of expertise or a lot of money or any of those things. So it's been a really interesting evolution of the business. And like I said, it probably wasn't until 5 or 6 years ago that we decided to shift over full time to work on Pickfood, because it really started to gain its own momentum. And we started to figure out which customer niches were really needing this particular solution.
Interesting. So yeah, let's zoom into that. So were there any niches in the market where this problem was more mission critical than others?
Yeah, so I think as we, it was a very general purpose tool, and we started seeing people using it in a lot of different ways. So first we saw authors using it for book titles and book covers, which is great. Not a ton of repeat usage, you know, also not a ton of revenue from self-publishing authors. We started seeing some businesses where you're doing it for landing pages and idea validation, but the use cases that we saw that had the most impact on their business was actually e-commerce businesses. So testing out product design, branding, logos, marketing creatives, all of those things. If you're selling in retail or online, you're making huge investments of thousands of dollars into your product. You're launching campaigns and all of these things you can't take back. You can't really test things live. And so that's where we found the biggest impact. Similar with gaming companies. So a lot of gaming companies, they're testing game characters and game UX, because a lot of those things you're going to invest a ton of development hours into. You're going to launch this huge game, which took millions of dollars. And so you really want to get that right. Otherwise, the launch is going to fail. You're not going to get the downloads. Your reviews are going to suffer. So it's all about gathering this feedback earlier in the process, so that by the time you launch, you have a product that you've already kind of gotten all the negative feedback out of the way.
Makes so much sense, you know, and I like the point that you made there. That's, yes, it's a generic tool. And a lot of companies say, okay, well, we build this horizontal product and everyone can use it.
Yeah.
And then you end up in this trap. Not only that you get a lot of tire kickers and they're going to use it, like you say, once or twice. I've tested my book cover with friends and family and people on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I didn't even consider using a tool like yours, but it would be a one-off thing. I'm working on my next book, but it's delayed. But I completely agree with you that what to look for is at the end the use case whereby this is becoming super valuable problem to solve and critical also for success. And mm-hmm. there's repeat in there. And I think that's the most important thing. Otherwise, you get a lot of people signing up and then churning a month later. Yeah, I agree. E-commerce, gaming, and likely going to be a couple of others of those. So, how did that change the trajectory of your company? When did you find out?
Yeah, so it was around 2018, 2019, we started getting mentioned in more e-commerce conferences and podcasts and things like that. And it really opened our eye to the repetitive nature that they needed to use a tool like this, because typically there's you're selling a lot of different product lines, a lot of different SKUs. You're testing a lot of different pieces throughout the product process. Like I said, branding, packaging, design, logos, your main image in Amazon, incredibly important to get that click, all of your marketing copy. So that was kind of the inflection point that we started seeing a lot more repeat usage from larger sellers, a lot larger retailers. And so that's when we decided to pivot our attention and go full time and really start building out the team and going after this mission of democratizing consumer research, because not only were we resonating amongst the smaller businesses, but we were starting to see a lot of corporate and enterprise companies coming in, because while they may have consumer insights teams and access to expensive research services, the people doing the work, you know, the people, the creative designer and the marketing manager who's just trying to optimize some small thing, isn't going to be able to tap into their insights team for something so small. And so now they can do something for like $50, get feedback on some imagery, and really have that confidence to iterate and launch smaller campaigns or design tweaks.
Makes total sense. What actually surprises me that it took from 2008 to 2018 to figure out, okay, that aha moment. Why did you do you think it required that time? Or was it because it was a side business for a long time?
Yeah, it was a side business, and we were kind of focused on our other business for a while, and we were slowly evolving, but all throughout that time, we were slowly evolving the platform as we were using it, and we started seeing the organic usage, like I said, for the authors and publishers. We started seeing some game companies using it at that time. And so the product continued to evolve, and we built up more kind of institutional knowledge about the problem space and really trying to understand research in general, because we were coming at it from an outsider perspective. You know, we hadn't done market research as a career. So there was a lot of learning. And I think that outside perspective has allowed us to build kind of this disruptive solution that packages like a very simple thing, but does a lot of things for the end user, requiring them not to have that expertise or those budgets.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really a bottom-up movement.
Yes.
And exactly. I mean, just for my own mindset, are you specializing in a product-led growth type motion, or is it also sales-led mode?
Yeah, very product-led growth. So we try to make it so that anyone can come off the street, anyone can sign up for free, get a creative free account, and start using us, pay as you go. There's no subscription barrier to using it. So we definitely recognize that a lot of our customers have, you know, perhaps like a testing cadence. You know, maybe they go through a phase of design for a few months and then they're heads down. They don't necessarily need a subscription. So we want to make sure that we're always accessible to everyone, even though, you know, we do have larger customers that have testing on a recurring basis, and we do have plans and things like that for them.
Yeah, okay. Makes sense. Okay, well, 2018, then of course, you see that there's momentum is created. What happened then? How did it take off? And then how has that changed your approach to running the business?
Yeah, I mean, at that time, we decided to start investing in growth. And so we started hiring and building up the team quite a bit. That started leading into 2020, you know, during the pandemic. And we grew the team to about 20 people, which is still where we're at about now. But we focus a lot more on e-commerce, really focus on building up the product team to improve the quality of an experience and then increase the number of features that we have. We built out the customer success team because we found that even though it's a product-led growth service, you still need to hop on a call. You need to guide people through how to use the service every now and then. There's larger customers who need handholding through procurement or training, all that kind of stuff. So we do have a customer success team. And then the marketing, of course. So we definitely picked up the marketing specifically into those two industries. So e-commerce and gaming, just trying to make those use cases more obvious and then increasing our brand presence in those spaces.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm always interested in to see, like what have been early decisions that you took with the team I'm not sure whether you have to go back all the way to 2008, but you can best decide. What has been a fundamental decision that is really helping in the success that you're seeing right now?
Well, I guess two things. First of all, you know, starting to segment the focus on those industries, I think is super important because, like you said, it's really hard to market a general purpose tool. But when you're able to speak directly to people about their problems and the use cases, it resonates so much more quickly. Even as an author, if I say like, oh, it helps you test book titles and book covers, okay, like it, you know, it makes sense, right? So for e-commerce and gaming, doing the marketing and starting to tailor the product much more specifically to those industries, I think is really important to our getting our traction.
Let me make a small interruption here. Justin just made a critical remark about what determines how they've been able to accelerate traction. Niching down to two industries where the product wasn't a nice to have, but a critical to have. It's the same product, the same use case, but a radically different value perception from customers. It accelerates everything and means the difference between high churn and hardly no churn. And that matters. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They focus on the essence, then acknowledge that they cannot please everyone, and then package their offer to be most valuable and desirable. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
I think the other decision point was going fully remote and conscientiously going very global in our hiring of our team, because what we found was so many of our customers are non-US. I would say over half of our customers are outside the US, and especially because so many people are building things that sell into the US marketplace. And that's kind of where we started with our panel of people, that we wanted to make sure that our product was built by as diverse a crowd as our customer base. And so we really focus on hiring people from all the different, you know, every different country, all the different time zones, and trying to make sure that all those cultural and language considerations are taken into consideration when we're building the platform. And just even as we deal with customers and our marketing, just making sure that we're very intentional about being inclusive to anyone who could be using our platform, because it is PLG. So we have people coming off the street, literally around the world, and using it to test people in the US. And now we're in Australia, UK, Canada, Germany, Mexico, and Japan as well for our audiences.
I remember from an earlier podcast that I did, of course, this is sort of a marketplace. You know, people not only build the flow in order to test things and give an understanding about what they want to test, but then it's about, now I want to have an audience. And that's, of course, something you have to build as well. So, yeah, I mean, go-to-market for you is really choosing your markets and from there on build the audiences there so that it's relevant. How do you do that?
So we choose the countries that we have our panel in based off, now that we're kind of focused on e-commerce and gaming, by kind of those marketplaces. So we look at, you know, for Amazon, what are the top Amazon marketplaces? We look at gaming. What are the, you know, the fastest growing gaming markets, and then kind of looking for the intersection points and focusing on those. And then for our panel, we actually tap into the same consumer research panels that large companies like Procter & Gamble and Kraft would be using for their longer form consumer research. But we do so in a programmatic way, and we have our own layer of data quality and audience targeting on top of all of those to make it so that all those things that you needed expertise around, you know, around using these panels and cleaning the data and doing the data analysis are all automated through our platform so that you don't need to know how to do any of those things. So that's kind of the differentiator that we have, so that, you know, anyone off the street, not knowing that they're doing research, is doing research, you know, almost as good as some of these more expensive consultants.
Yeah, exactly. Are you focusing on specific use cases where the data quality is really important, maybe from a decision perspective, because enormous decisions are dependent on it. Because of course, that's also a use case in itself, right? That's like, who is actually, I've recently had a conversation with, for example, the CEO from Wellcome and another platform whereby they are bringing really high profile people to the platform, because that is the difficulty part. but for maybe testing whether a design of a picture, which one to take, you've got a different principle. So how do you go about guaranteeing the level of quality that people expect?
Yeah, so we do focus more on things like preference testing images or gathering open-ended feedback to questions. You know, for example, like if you're targeting moms about a new diaper bag, maybe you're asking them like, what are the issues that you're having with your diaper bags? Or, you know, I'm thinking about selling this new concept, like what do you like or dislike about it? Those kinds of things. And one of the differentiators for us is that we do require everyone to always give a written explanation. And so that written explanation allows us to do a lot more vetting of how intentional they are when they're answering the question. So we have a lot of automated and human curated means to filter out the people who are just kind of, you know, mailing it in to get that incentive. So we do a lot of filtering on our side to make sure that those written explanations are genuine and they're helpful. And so when you buy 50 responses from us, we try to guarantee that all 50 are very high quality and you don't have to reject any of them yourself.
So it's not only automation, so there's also a human component to it.
Yeah, it's kind of a blend, just to make sure that you try to catch everything.
Now, how do you scale to that? I mean, you're talking about your team is 20, or do you outsource those type of things to other people?
Yeah, there's a lot of techniques. I mean, we don't have to human vet every single response, it kind of just the exceptions.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's where automation comes in again.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah, so early decision to segment, to get the traction there, and remote and global is the most important things to move faster forward. So how do you then, I mean, I'm always like interested, is it the chicken and the egg situation? Because you said in 2018, we started to see that we were being mentioned in conferences and so on.
Yeah.
How are you going about creating momentum here? How do you go to your, let's go through the journey of your first 100 customers.
Yeah, I mean, those happened before that time. Those were more organic. As we were in the author space, we were popular with book marketing consultants. So there's a lot of content, as you know, as an author, around publishing books and how to market your books. And so we were getting inserted into a lot of those blog posts and podcasts and things like that. And so that's where a lot of our early customers came from. We were also getting promoted by kind of other entrepreneurs that were using it for idea validation. We were participating in a lot of startup weekends. So back then, mm-hmm. startup weekends and kind of like these weekend hackathons were really popular. And so we would reach out and we would give free coupons to people to try it out there. And so like those were also really good lead generators. And so, yeah, it was just a lot of hustle trying different avenues of getting it into the hands of people to try out, because it was one of those things where it sounds interesting, but until you've tried it, you won't really have that aha moment. And then you'll see like, oh, wow, this is really interesting to be able to get 50 random people responding within 15 minutes on something that's mine. And a lot of times they're going to say some stuff that really resonates with you, or maybe you never thought of, but once you see it, you're like, oh, wow, I never considered that. Like, I'm glad I got that outside perspective. So we really wanted as many people to try it. And yeah, so the first 100 were, you know, a lot of word of mouth and a lot of hustle.
Yeah, exactly. So where are you now, customer base wise? I mean, thousands?
Thousands. Yeah, we do a lot of kind of affiliate influencer marketing in the e-commerce space. There's a lot of content out there. So a lot of people teaching how to do e-commerce, a lot of people talking about it on podcasts, on YouTube and things like that. So that's one avenue that we focus on. Of course, blog content as well. So, you know, we definitely write a lot of content about how to do market research in a very simple way. So we try not to have all the jargon that, you know, the more traditional content might have, but really focus on the use case, because, you know, no one cares about what the technique is. They just want to know, like, well, how do I get feedback on my main image or my product design or whatever it is? And that's the kind of stuff that we focus on.
Yeah, that is always the main issue, right? To have a Swiss Army knife is a tool that can be used for anything. And then, of course, no one is searching for anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was a challenge we had in the beginning, was no one's searching for us. So how are we going to, you know, how are we going to rank? Well, once we started discovering that, well, they're not searching for us, but they're searching for how to do these certain jobs, right? So if we start talking about those particular jobs, then they'll discover us and like, oh, okay, like, you know, I can use it for that. So, you know, it's like Airtable and a lot of these other tools that are super generic, but they kind of niche in on like, oh, you could use it as a CRM or whatever it is. And then that's how people discover it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's completely the other way around. But that's the way to do it. And of course, for these type of tools, it's a long journey because there are so many use cases.
Yeah.
And it's really the compounding effect because the volume of searches is low. But then, altogether, they still make traffic.
Yeah.
Interesting. On this journey, what has been the hardest nut to crack to break through your growth barrier?
I think for us, it's kind of like that cyclical nature of testing. And so it's definitely not a subscription that you set and forget necessarily, right? So, a lot of other SaaS tools, you just sign up, maybe you integrate a script or it's doing something for you automatically. For us, it does take a user intent to run. So in a way, we're kind of more similar to an e-commerce company, right? Because like you're transacting each time and we kind of have to stay top of mind. So I think that's our biggest challenge. And that's kind of like what the product team is focused on right now is, making it so that people can build that habit or we can be integrated into your processes, or maybe there are automated things that we can do for you. So that's kind of our big focus right now. And I think it's a challenge for anyone that's doing something similar, right? Like where there's a lot of user intention, like people can churn because like they think they'll have a need and then they'll think that they don't and they'll cancel it or just stop using
it. Yeah, that's true. So how do you, interesting to see what has worked for you. How do you keep it top of mind? And how do you also kind of, do you spend a lot of time on educating people about what else they can use it for?
Yeah. So that's one of the challenges is that education aspect. It's always fascinating when we talk to customers, even customers that have been using us for years really well. And you get them on the phone and you tell them like, hey, have you tried this, this, and this? And you get to see it in their eyes like, oh my God, I never even thought that you could do those kinds of things. And so there's always something more you could teach your customers. And I feel like even if you think you've communicated it well through, whatever product marketing content you have out there, there's still nothing like hopping on the phone with someone and kind of explaining different use cases to them. So, we try to find scalable ways to do more of that education. And then it really is just building a habit. I think the accounts that have been successful and consistent are ones that have built an organization and culture of data-driven decision-making and using it on a lot of different aspects and spreading it throughout the team that, hey, if you're going to be doing something that's going to be published or going to see our customers, like let's test it out. And so we've got quite a number of customers that, literally put the Pickfu poll in their Asana task as like a proof of that they've validated this decision. And it's like, okay, we're good to go. Like we tested it. Next, whether it's ads or UX or marketing copy, it's just a final validation that, hey, it's more than just me and my team who looked at it. It's some other people.
Exactly. That's true. Yeah. And that's gold when you get customers to do that and it's becoming part of their processes because it's so easy to forget.
Yes.
Opportunity that you have there.
Yeah.
And because it's so versatile. I mean, there's how many, if you look at what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, how many things you can actually test and get some feedback on. Yeah, that's true. So do you have an active way of nurturing your customers? Do you maybe have a weekly tip or a daily tip? Do you have communities? I mean, is this something whereby you can actually grow through community?
We haven't explored the community aspect. I think that's interesting because it would be cool for them to share like their different ways of using it, different tips. We do have our periodic email newsletters, things like that. So we do try to educate and share information through those means. And then we publish to the blog and social media pretty frequently as well. So any of the customers that have opted into following those channels do get a lot of information. And then even, me and my co-founder hopping on podcasts and kind of reinforcing the different use cases is another way to reach customers.
Yeah, like we're doing here, exactly.
Yes.
So what I write about a lot is this whole art of, getting towards product market fit and you're there. Get thousands of customers. I mean, it's proven. But then, of course, there's always this interesting thing of how do you then scale and how do you get towards profitability? And by the way, is it a bootstrap company or is it backed by VCs?
No, we've always been bootstrapped. So no, just going for profits.
So what has been a fundamental lesson that you learned along the way that you say, okay, well, I wish I'd known that before around getting towards profitability?
Let's see. Well, we did go through a period of time where having a tight reins on the financials, especially as you're bootstrapped and kind of cash is king. I think during growth phases, it's, you know, easy to take your eye off it. And so it wasn't until we got a fractional CFO to kind of really tighten down the numbers and kind of help us do the projections a little bit better that we feel a lot more confident around kind of our spending and growth plans.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my co-founder and I don't have a, you know, we're not accountants or have a finance background. So while we can look at the general numbers, like, you know, doing that kind of analysis and projection wasn't within our wheelhouse. So I think that's something you got to worry about more as a bootstrap company, because we do want to grow and we're trying to invest as much as possible into growth. And so you're always kind of tiptoeing on that line of, you know, you're trying to push the envelope, right, in terms of like growing as quickly as possible, but like leaving enough in the bank. So yeah, that's a challenge that I think we've overcome now, or we feel more confident about it at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see that you need someone that actually owns that thing,
yes,
that job, yeah, as a fractional CMO to tell you. But is it always about the financial things, right? I mean, what are the metrics that become very important to you that even you, as a non-finance person, look at every week, every month?
We're always looking at, you know, sign-up rate, activation rate, kind of customer churn, those kinds of things. We're always looking at that onboarding process to seeing if people are getting to that aha moment. Because even if they don't activate right away, or, you know, maybe they churn immediately, if they've at least had that aha moment, then we've at least seeded it into their mind that this is a possibility for them. And so we do see a lot of people reactivating months later or years later, just because like they had that aha moment. And so we try to get as many people through that initial activation and experiencing what it means to do a pick, food, pull. So right now we have an onboarding process that allows them to try it for free for like 5 responses. And I think it really solidifies like, oh, this is what you mean. Like, now I get it. Because whenever we showed it to people in person as a demo, they would get it. But like, you know, that's not a scalable approach for PLG. So I think we're honing in on the right process right now.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of very important metrics from a PLG perspective. Do you also look at things like NRR? Because there's been a lot of writing the last couple of weeks since the end of 2023 about the downfall of NRR.
Yeah.
Every company in the world has dropped in the numbers. I think the average seems to be 113 right now, or not the average, but like the benchmark almost.
Yeah.
Do you look at those types of metrics as well, or ARR per employee?
We're starting to look at NRR, but we're trying to figure out the right way to calculate it for our kind of business. Since, like I said, it's not a subscription driven and it's more usage. And then also we're trying to filter out, narrow in on our ICP, our ideal customer profile, and kind of only looking at the numbers for that segment, because we're PLG and we're literally anyone can sign up and use us. Doesn't mean that we need to look at the numbers for every single person. And, you know, the people on the bottom end are going to churn and that's fine. Authors will use it once a year or once every 2 years. That's fine. And so if we looked at the blended numbers, like, it's always going to skew in a certain direction. And so we're kind of adjusting all of our analytics and also our kind of financial analysis, including NRR, to be able to hone in on a more narrow band of ideal customer profiles, so that we can track it a little bit more accurately and kind of focus our efforts on the customers that matter more. So that's kind of an ongoing process right now. Like, we've been doing a lot of discovery around, you know, the attributes of our ideal customers and gathering that information as part of the onboarding process, you know, which I think has become more popular in PLG, just kind of gathering as much information about like who you are and what you're trying to do. And then you could provide a more tailored experience for that user. And then you could also do better analytics on them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very smart to look at the subsegment, because that's at the end where you want to be the number one thought. And the rest is almost cherry and icing on the cake.
Yeah, it is.
Exactly. So, I mean, I we already talked about book covers. I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and I think I chose the right cover there. But it's about the, I mean, what fascinates me is about what defines those customer, those SaaS companies that we start talking about and keep talking about. And I mean, I think you're exemplified a couple of those examples whereby you need to be top of mind and you need to kind of create a wow moment so that people actually do talk about it. So is there any way in your company whereby you steer your people for a particular behavior in order to keep it always top of mind?
Well, we branding wise, we really try to drive home, you know, a lot of these messaging around know what sells before you sell it, test before you invest. If you don't know, pick through it. You know, really trying to drive pick-fooing as a verb for, you know, gathering data on something when you're not sure. And the tone of the company we try to have is very helpful, kind of data-driven, but fun and approachable. And so those are the ways that we try to kind of incept into people's minds. We're building some stuff into the product to make it a little bit more sticky and repetitive. But one of the things that we've done recently is reduce the number of responses down to 15 as the lowest minimum. So at $1 per response, that's only $15. And so for many businesses, that becomes almost a no-brainer to test things. And so what we're trying to drive is repetition and iterative testing. And if we can get you to do that for, let's say, your marketing imagery, and you keep testing variations, you're reading through the feedback, you make a new version, you keep testing it, it's so fast that you're doing it in the same day, then we're able to kind of fast track that habit building because, you know, you've only spent like $100, but you've run 5 or 6 polls and you've gotten a lot of reinforcement that like, hey, this is a good behavior. I'm getting really positive feedback. I'm making progress on my marketing creatives and I'm doing it all without leaving my desk and I'm getting, you know, all these different people to give me feedback. So that's how we've been trying to build that habit of pick-fooing it. And if we can do that for one person in a company, then making it shareable so that they can share it with their teammates and kind of spreading it, you know, landing and expanding that way.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way to do it at the end. It's that word of mouth and the aha moment, the habit building, all of those type of good things that that get it going. Yeah. And of course, it's so important for PLG. I mean, I have a lot of customers in the sales-led growth space, the companies that sell the enterprise types of solutions, and it's a non thing there. Although I think they could learn from it. So looking at the time as well, from your 16 years of entrepreneurship, and I realize, you know, it really started to get serious after 2018, so that's about 6 years down the road. From the lessons that you learned and the tidbits of wisdom that you've gained, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other aspiring tech entrepreneurs?
Let's see. I think the do would be to, it's just a lot of experimentation. I think, you know, that might be obvious, but I think you as an entrepreneur kind of has to try everything and you have to try to wear all the hats. You have to try to sell to customers. Even if you're not comfortable with it, you've got to try the marketing, even if you're not comfortable with it. So all those things, I think you have to try. And that kind of dovetails into the don't, which I think is thinking that a single hire might solve all your problems, or thinking that a guru who's like very well regarded and like, oh, I'm just going to pay this guy like a ton of money and he's going to come fix, you know, my sales process or whatever it is, because he's got some kind of pedigree. Like there's no the silver bullet, like it rarely ever works. And especially if you haven't done a little bit of yourself to really understand what the problem space is, what some of the issues are with the challenges that when you're doing sales, like if you don't know all the objections, then how can you expect someone that you're just going to hire to come in and be able to answer those questions really well? So I would say those are the do's and the don'ts kind of together.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting that you, I like your recommendations there. And it's so true because it's all, first of all, on the do and the don't side, hiring people, it's all so contextual.
Yeah,
and it can even well be that a person has all the experience in exactly the same vertical with exactly the same type of product, and it still won't work.
Yeah,
because the use cases are possibly different. There can be so many different things around that. And also, I like your point about, you know, that wearing all the hats. Literally last week,
yes,
we had a, I'm running a CEO mastermind, and every other week we have a hot seat, and one CEO takes the hot seat, and it was about marketing. And the point that came out was, I mean, I don't like marketing. I'm not good at it. I don't want to burn my hands on it. So I'm looking for, how do I solve it? Internal people, external people, exactly the same thing. I've hired all the people, the externals and the internals, and it never worked.
Yeah.
To your point, because you haven't figured out yourself.
Yeah.
What is key here? And yeah. I think that's so true. And how long have you, what is that point where, for example, you decided, okay, now it's time for me to hire someone in marketing to own that?
Yeah. I think after you've figured out some directional approaches or some, you know, channels that have gained traction, and so that you have a little bit of a framework for what direction you want to head in, because, you know, like you said, everyone for every position is coming from so many different experiences. And even if when you're hiring, like, what are you even going to judge them by? Because you can't just go off like, oh, well, they had all these successes in their past. Doesn't mean that they're going to be able to execute whatever plan or approach that you want to do. So if you don't have any kind of a framework or like kind of rough roadmap of the direction you're trying to head in, it's kind of hard to figure out if that exemplary candidate is even going to fit in and be able to execute it. So I think at that point when you're, all right, like, I think we've got something here. Now we can bring someone in to kind of like take that vision and run with it. It's probably the right time.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, even if you would consider doing funding, doing it only when you got something where you have the repetition that, you know, okay, I'm going to put $1 on it and it's going to turn out in 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, do what doesn't scale, right, until it's a problem. So, you know, you brute force the sales, you brute force the marketing, you see what traction you get, and then you move on.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much, Justin, for sharing the story about Pickfu. I like how you're actually, really working hard in order to get that printed into the minds of people like Google did.
Yes.
Pickfu it. And definitely you got a catchy name. And it's once you've heard it, you never forget about it. So I think that's a good thing in the same.
It gets
same
stuck thing. In there.
Exactly. So well, good luck on the rest. Yeah, part of the journey. Where can people go to find out more about Pickfu or to say hi to you?
Yeah. So you can check out pickfu.com, pickfu.com. Free to create an account. And like I said, we've got that onboarding process where you can try it out for free. And you could find me on LinkedIn. Just search for Justin Chen, Pickfu, and you'll be able to connect with me.
Okay. Well, that's a super simple lesson to follow. Thank you, and good luck.
All right. Thank you.
And this ends my conversation with Justin, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thanks for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Justin Chen, co-founder and CEO of Pickfu. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.